I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol has so far interviewed more than 800 witnesses, including many in former President Trump's inner circle. Seemingly only a handful have refused to participate. So far, the committee's work has mostly been done behind closed doors, but public hearings could start as soon as next month. Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming, one of just two Republicans on the committee, told CNN last week that she and her fellow members have a lot to share with the nation.
You've seen just in the last few days a plea agreement from one of the leaders of the Proud Boys, which lays out in really chilling detail the extent to which violence was planned, the extent to which the message that went out on December 19th about the rally in Washington, and don't forget, Donald Trump tweeted out that message, be there, be wild, that the day after that message, the organization and the planning started, and that they knew that they were going to attempt to use violence to try to stop the transfer of power. That is the definition of an insurrection, and it is absolutely chilling.
This hour, On Point, the committee on the January 6th insurrection prepares to go public. Joining me from Washington is Betsy Woodruff Swan, national correspondent for Politico. She's been covering the House Select Committee's investigation into the events of January 6th. And we have a link to her latest story at our website, onpointradio.org. Betsy, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me, Kimberly.
Also with me from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. Jack, welcome to you too.
Hello, Kimberly. Hello, Betsy.
So, Betsy, I want to start with you. What do we know about the timing of this change in the committee's work from being largely behind closed doors to be delivering a very public message to the American people?
The most important thing we know is that there's a massive amount of time pressure on the panel to get out the story that it's now spent many, many months putting together. Congressional committee members have been noncommittal about any particular weeks or dates when we could expect these hearings to come. But, you know, to your point, we are expecting potentially as soon as next month for the panel to begin the process of doing public hearings. Another big challenge that creates a lot of additional time pressure for the Select Committee is that they've also said a core project they're undertaking will be making legislative recommendations, you know, potential laws that at least could be proposed and debated in Congress that would be intended to strengthen the safeguards around the American democratic process so that we don't have another episode where, you know, the responsibility of the vice president is the only thing keeping the certification of a presidential election from moving forward. And the massive amount of time pressure that exists on the legislative front is even more pressing than on the hearing front. And that's because there's just a limited amount of floor time. There's a limited amount of time when the Senate's in session. There's always stiff competition from all corners of the federal government for access to that time. And if the Select Committee is serious about, you know, not just telling a story, but making legislative change or doing everything in their power to make legislative change, that's something where the time pressure is just getting more and more acute by the day.
And Jack, talk a little bit more about that, the peril of waiting too long to make this public case.
Well, they're going to run out of time. There's an election coming up, and the Democrats are certainly almost certain to lose the House in that election. And their one hope, I think, seems to be that they can put something on the board, that they can have something to run on, charges against Trump, perhaps charges against members of the House, or at least scandals about connections between Republican members of the House and rally organizers and or insurrectionists. So it'll give them something to put forward in that election where it seems like the Democrats are not going to have very much going for them otherwise.
So I want to talk a little bit about what we've learned so far from what committee members have said and from leaks that have come out. Of course, we heard from Congresswoman Cheney earlier, who has also said that there are findings that former President Trump acted unlawfully. We've also learned that in the days after the attack on the Capitol, Republicans in Congress huddled to decide how to respond. The New York Times reports that House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy told colleagues on a conference call that he would advise President Trump to resign. After that report, McCarthy tweeted that the allegation was, quote, totally false and wrong. Now, the Times has released a recording that confirms their story. Here is part of what the congressman told fellow Republicans on a conference call.
I do not want to get into any conversation about Pence pardoning. Again, I mean, the only discussion I would have with him is that I think this will pass, and it would be my recommendation we should resign. I mean, that would be my take, but I don't think he would take it, but I don't know.
So, Betsy, to you, what do we know so far? The committee hasn't made its full report public yet, but there has been a steady stream of information through voicemails, through texts that sort of paint the picture, particularly about what the president and what members of Congress were doing on January 6th.
That's right. There's been just a massive influx of information that the committee has collected over the last several months. What we've seen just in the last few weeks is that there's almost an extent to which the dam has broken when it comes to very, very senior Trump administration officials and even Trump family members cooperating with the panel. You know, when this investigation first started, if you'd told me that Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump were going to voluntarily answer questions, I would have rolled my eyes and said that I had a bridge to sell you. But here we are. They both have voluntarily participated, neither under a subpoena. We also know that two top White House lawyers, Pat Cipollone and Patrick Philbin, have both engaged with the committee within the last few weeks, answering questions from investigators in an informal setting. You don't get much more senior than that group of people. And additionally, the news also broke yesterday that the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., is expected to testify to investigators in the coming weeks. So they've gotten tons of information. They've gotten reams and reams and reams of documents from within the Trump White House through the National Archives. And now they're also getting witnesses essentially lining up to make sure that their versions of the story are part of the official record that's going to come out. And frankly, that's a challenge for the probe because, you know, as anyone who's done reporting can tell you, sometimes you can have issues with having an embarrassment of riches where you get so much information, you get so many documents that just reading through everything, making sense of it and processing it is much more time consuming than you would have expected. That's where the committee is at right now. And, you know, as we mentioned earlier, it's a race against the clock.
And in addition to the information we're getting from the committee's probe, there are external factors such as the California district judge who said in a ruling that it was more likely than not that the former president acted illegally to obstruct Congress. That doesn't have any precedential value, but it got a lot of headlines. Of course, there's also the ongoing debate about what, if anything, the Department of Justice is going to do in response to January 6th when it comes to either the former president or those at the highest level. We're going to get into that more later. But Jack, talk a little bit now about what Betsy was talking about, this challenge of taking all of this abundance of information and creating what needs to be a very simple narrative for the American people to digest and believe.
Well, there have been reports that they're hiring or thinking of hiring journalists or a journalist writer to help them figure out how to present this material in a written form. But the key really is the hearings are what matter. And there, they could perhaps go to a Hollywood director. What they don't need at those hearings, to venture an opinion, are speeches from the members of the panel. At the end, they're fine. But I can't think of anything that would stop pulses immediately than hearing, you know, one member after another begin that way. And I completely agree with Fred Wertheimer, the former head of Common Cause and activist for transparency in government, that the focus from start to finish should be on Trump and his involvement, because that's the part of this that looks ahead. All of this is going to be documenting what happened, but Trump lives on. And if Trump, the only thing worse than Trump winning the next presidential election is Trump losing it. Because as Michael Luttig, the former appeals court justice, Republican, said this week, that his losing that election is a clear and present danger to the democracy, because Trump has signaled that he will bring the temple down, refuse to accept the outcome, perhaps, call for violence in the streets. The way to avoid that is to have him off the ticket. How to do that? It would be grand from the point of view of the future of the Republic if he could either be under indictment or in jail.
So, Betsy, when the committee is moving to this public phase, we've already had several instances where the former president was at the center of very public hearings. We had that with the special counsel in the Mueller investigation, and we had it in two impeachments. How might this look different from that?
It's a good question. This investigation is, perhaps comparable in scope to special counsel Robert Mueller's probe, in that it's been running for quite a while and they've talked to an enormous number of people. The difference is that some members of the January 6th Select Committee in some ways feel that they've gotten some lessons learned from the Russia probe over the course of the investigation into the interactions between Trump's campaign and people close to the Russian government. At the end of that process, there was a sense that the public hearings that happened and the report from the special counsel that came out didn't actually do much to change public opinion. Essentially,
well, I'm going to hold you right there, and we're going to talk more on the other side. We're talking about the Select Committee ongoing investigation into the January 6th insurrection on Capitol Hill. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. My guests are Betsy Woodruff Swan, national correspondent for Politico, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. And I'd like to bring in another voice into the conversation. Raymond Smock joins us from Martinsburg, West Virginia. He's the former historian of the U.S. House of Representatives. He's also the former and now interim director of the Robert C. Byrd Center at Sheppard University. He has studied congressional investigations going back to the founding of the Republic, and he's co-editor of the two-volume work, Congress Investigates. Ray, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be with you, Kimberly.
So before we get into what has happened during this investigative phase, I want to put to you the point that we were making on the other side of the break. What do you see as the big challenge to members of this committee in crafting this public narrative after such an extensive investigation into January 6th?
Well, I've been listening to what Jack and Betsy said earlier, and they've put their finger on a number of interesting points. This is, to my understanding, the single most important congressional investigation in United States history, because it had to deal with the overthrow of the government, and first time that the Constitution itself has been that challenged. The report, as others have said, is got to be a strong narrative. It's got to be a gigantic civics lesson for the nation, but done in a compelling way that people can understand. There's so many aspects to this, so many aspects of how the Constitution was violated, how laws were violated, and getting that into a clear message is going to be the single most important thing. And I agree with Jack that it shouldn't be the committee members we hear from. It should be the report itself. This report should sell better than the Starr report did, which was the single greatest selling government document ever issued when the Clinton impeachment occurred. And in other words, it needs to be that well known and that well spread. It can't be something that, and I think it will be, just by the very nature of it, it's going to be big.
Right. Put this in context with other historical investigations in terms of the enormity of the volume of information that has been collected and having to go through that and pull from that in order to craft a message that is simple and easily digestible.
Well, you know, the amount of material is drawn will eventually be simply cataloged. This could be a multiple volume report, but the essence of that report needs to be in one volume that everybody can understand. And the truth of the matter is there will be some aspects of this that we won't see. It won't be released. There's classified documents that will have a time limit on it, and that eventually will be accessed through the Freedom of Information Act. But I think there's so much that is public. And the unique thing about this, so much of it happened in public right before our very eyes. So that's hardly classified information. So I think a lot will be available. And the rest of it, the supporting documents, those will simply be compiled, probably printed. The assassination of JFK was 26 volumes, but nobody read the whole thing. They wanted the conclusions. They wanted to understand the narrative.
So, Betsy, we talked a little bit already about so many people who have testified, and we know that there have been hundreds of people. Some of them we know who they are, like Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump. We know that there will be more being investigated. There also have been a few who have defied the committee's request to investigate and have had those refusals referred criminally to the Department of Justice. How do you think that impacts this investigation, Betsy?
There's no question that the investigation would benefit if, you know, particularly if Mark Meadows, who was Trump's chief of staff the day of January 6th, was participating and answering questions. They've received from Meadows scores, I believe thousands of text messages, but many, many documents in general, when you get them, it's just more helpful if you have a person explaining context and timing and the story behind these conversations. Meadows is probably the most significant person who has thus far refused to sit for a live in-person interview with congressional investigators. And that does create something of a blind spot for them. It's a problem that he's not cooperating. That said, of course, the level of cooperation that they've gotten from other senior White House officials is going to be far more than enough to put together a very interesting and very newsworthy document. But it is a gap that Meadows isn't cooperating with the panel. And of course, we know they would love to have have gotten Steve Bannon to cooperate. He was sort of the first penguin off the iceberg in terms of defying the panel, and his trial for charges of contempt of Congress is set for this summer. So it's possible that that trial will be happening concurrently with congressional hearings and or the release of documents related to the probe.
And Ray, we also know that there are missing White House call logs, 7 hours, more than 7 hours worth of missing call logs. How might the committee work to try to fill in that gap? And obviously that's very, that reminds us all of Watergate and the missing 18 minutes. Seven hours is a lot longer.
Yeah, 7 hours is a lot longer. And I think that can be filled in by other phone calls and other people's phones, if we could get access to them. The people who did talk to Trump that day, I think we know of a number of people who did talk to the president that day during the 7 hour and 34 minute period that there is no log. Of course, the fact that that log is missing is in itself a violation of the Presidential Records Act, although the Presidential Records Act has no teeth in it, no penalty particularly, but that could be obstruction of justice, which is a serious crime.
And let's talk now more about how this message will be conveyed. Barry Berke was special counsel in the first Trump impeachment trial and chief counsel in the second impeachment trial. He told us why the Select Committee's forthcoming hearings will be very different in tone from the impeachment trials.
This House hearing will be different than the House hearings we had in the first impeachment, where you had a bitterly divided Judiciary Committee with Democrats and Republicans. Here, because both the Democrats and Republicans on the Select Committee are committed to presenting the facts, that will help this hearing this in the House be presented in a way that is seamless, so the evidence could be understood. And I expect that the members of the committee are going to work very, very closely with the tremendous investigative folks that they have who put this together to make sure that when they tell this narrative, one member will then hand it off to the other, almost like a relay race with a baton.
And so, Jack, talk a little bit about that. I mean, this will feel different from the impeachment trials, which I think had the effect of really just solidifying the divisions in public opinion that already existed. This difference in tone, one messenger passing the baton clearly to the next, how do you think that will play differently?
Well, I'd like to say that it would galvanize public opinion, that it would open the eyes of many people who've fallen for the Trump big lie, but I'm doubtful about that. I'm afraid that polarization has reached a point where people are proof against revelation, proof against the truth. So I don't hold out any hope that this will be a conversion experience for the third or maybe less, but something around that of the population that seems to be hook, line, and sinker in the Trump cult.
And Ray, how might this message be conveyed? It's a different time from the time of Watergate or other previous investigations where there were fewer media sources, fewer media venues. So America kind of collectively watched it all together. In today's age with social media and very divergent media, how might the committee members keep that in mind when they're trying to make this case to the public?
Well, they're going to have a written narrative. And of course, there's going to be a textual narrative, which is the basis of all of it. But there's so much footage, there's so much film, there's so much material from social media and recordings of phone calls and so on that will play out. The story has to be told in two ways, as a book and then in multimedia. And the multimedia is what most of the people will see, although I do think a lot of people are going to pick up the book when it comes out, too. And I hope it's a big, fat, thick one. The Clinton impeachment was 460 pages or something like that, and people scarfed it up off the shelves. But this is a multimedia event, and I think it will be played that way.
Betsy, what one thing that has been going on simultaneously, but certainly relatedly to the committee's work, is the investigation by the Department of Justice. And California Democrat Adam Schiff is a member of the Select Committee, and he was speaking with Judy Woodruff on PBS NewsHour on March 29th, and he said the Justice Department, led by Attorney General Merrick Garland, needs to move forward on criminal charges stemming from the insurrection, and that the clock is ticking.
The Justice Department needs to move on these criminal referrals. We're trying to prevent another attack like January 6th, and we feel a real sense of urgency about it. It's not just an obligation of Congress to be looking into that for accountability. It's also the obligation of the Justice Department.
And do you hold the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, responsible?
Ultimately, the buck stops with the Attorney General. So I am concerned that credible allegations of illegality, serious allegations, may not be under investigation when they should be.
So, Betsy, I think it can be confusing with the committee's work, which is really, as you said, about establishing the record, creating a clear narrative, and their action can include things like passing legislation aimed at making sure this doesn't happen again. When it comes to crimes that may have been committed, that is with the Justice Department. It's up to the Justice Department to make those determinations. But how are they working together? Is the Justice Department relying on the committee and the other way around?
That's right. DOJ never moves quickly enough for Congress, regardless of the issue, regardless of the allegations of lawbreaking. Members of Capitol Hill are always frustrated that the department isn't moving more quickly. The fact that they brought criminal charges against Steve Bannon just a few weeks after receiving a referral from Congress was pretty shocking, just in terms of the timeline. I spoke with people who've worked at DOJ handling those types of referrals who told me that it frequently would take, you know, at least 3 to 6 months to make charging decisions. The fact that they moved as quickly as they did in Bannon's case is something that members of Congress who want to see more action from DOJ should find heartening. In terms of the cooperation between Select Committee investigators and the Justice Department, what we do know is that federal judges handling sentencing of people who are either plead guilty or who are convicted of crimes at the Capitol building on January 6th have communicated to those defendants that they could receive leniency in their sentencing if they cooperate with the Select Committee probe. We know many of the people who've pleaded guilty to attacking police officers or breaking into the Capitol building have also engaged with the Select Committee and shared information with them as well. What we also know, though, and I think this is perhaps the most important January 6th news that we've had in the last 6 months, but also oddly enough, has gotten significantly less media attention and oxygen than the congressional news. What we also now know is that the Justice Department is using a federal grand jury based in Washington, D.C., to ask people not just about the violence outside the Capitol building, but to ask questions about the plans to try to use alternate electors to reverse the election results. They're using this federal grand jury to ask people about the organizing of the rally at the Ellipse that happened prior to and then overlapped a bit with the violence at the Capitol building. That means that people at the Justice Department believe that there could have been lawbreaking in relation to the Ellipse rally and in relation to the alternate electors schemes. Both of those two topics, of course, are directly connected to President Trump himself and to his inner circle. DOJ is always just way, 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 way less public about the work that it's doing than congressional investigators are. That's simply the nature of the beast. Members of Congress find it frustrating. Sometimes, because things seem to be quiet at DOJ, it's because nothing's going on. Other times, it's because, you know, it's a duck on a pond, and above the pond, everything looks calm and quiet, but the duck's feet are moving really, really quickly. And what we've learned over the last few months is that, oh, the duck feet, to torture the analogy a little bit, are moving a lot more quickly than we expected.
And Ray, I mean, it's important to know we also have some reporting that there has been some division within the committee about whether to make criminal referrals to the Department of Justice. Of course, the DOJ does not have to wait for a referral to act. But talk a little bit historically about this interplay between a massive congressional and very public, soon to be public congressional investigation and the work on the legalities on the Justice Department when it comes to whether crimes were committed?
Well, one of the cases that was the most dramatic in terms of a conflict between the Justice Department and what Congress was doing was the Iran-Contra affair in 1987, where the Reagan administration was selling weapons to Iran and using that money illegally to fund a rebellion in Nicaragua against a specific law. What happened in that case was a number of people were given immunity by Congress, and later, then, when the Justice Department went after people like Ollie North and John Poindexter, who were deeply involved in the whole matter, they were found guilty of crimes, but then ultimately exonerated, let go, because of the Congress had given them immunity earlier. So there's a real tough tug of war between whether you give immunity, whether you don't give immunity. In this case, I think the Congress learned its lesson after Iran-Contra not to be giving out immunity wholesale just to get information. In this case, they had ample information from a lot of sources. But whether the committee does a referral to the Justice Department or not, I know that they're divided on that right now. And I remember when Zoe Lofgren, in a testimony, wasn't part of her written thing, but she expressed frustration. We're doing our part. It's time for the Justice Department to do their part.
All right, I'm going to hold you right there, and we'll go to a break. We are discussing the January 6th probe into the insurrection last year. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. My guests are Ray Smock, a former historian of the U.S. House of Representatives, Betsy Woodruff Swan, national correspondent for Politico, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. And we're talking about the way, the case that the January 6th committee will have to make to the American public once the investigation goes into the public-facing phase. And I want to play some sound from Garrett Graff. He's a journalist and historian who wrote a book on the Watergate hearings. Here's what he told On Point about how this committee will or should move forward.
Congress has a role to explain to the American people what happened. Their goal, I think, is to tell a story of the president's moral and political culpability for the actions of January 6th. They don't actually care at the end of the day about criminal responsibility. That is and still will be the responsibility of Merrick Garland's Justice Department to sort out.
So, Jack, do you agree? Do you think that it is the job of the committee to focus on the moral culpability and leave the criminal culpability to the Attorney General?
Well, they don't want to interfere they don't want to cross wires with the Attorney General. And apparently there had been some chariness about that, not wanting to seem to be pressuring him. But I'm very leery about this idea of focusing on the moral part of it. This doesn't go any further than Mitch McConnell the day after the insurrection, where he said Trump is morally culpable. Well, yes, it hasn't done a thing to Trump's standing with Republicans, apparently. I would like at least the committee to at least sort of forecast, preview the landscape of criminal charges. And the website Just Security has prepared a charging document that shows that lays out the evidence and the law pointing to Trump's culpability. Two felonies in particular. One, conspiracy to defraud the United States. That's punishable up to 5 years. And the second, interfering with an official proceeding of government. That one has a sentence of up to 20 years. And they amass massive public evidence that's just out there under these charges showing how Trump could be indicted under these things. I would like to hear a lot of that from the committee so that people get a sense of, yes, Trump is responsible politically, responsible morally. He also broke the law.
Ray, do you think that the committee can do all of those messages, all that messaging that Jack is talking about?
They're going to need a lot of help from everyone else that's in the news business, people in universities. This should be a national dialogue, a national civics lesson, a morality lesson, an ethics lesson, an ethics. If we can do it that way, to expect 9 members of a committee then to explain all this to the country, especially in the polarized times that we're in. We've been polarized a long time, but it's really bad now. And we know, as Jack mentioned earlier, at least a third of the country probably isn't going to believe anything that the committee says. And so it's going to be an uphill battle. And there's going to be forces out there, propaganda from various sources, that will challenge whatever the committee says. So it's a big assignment, but we can't fail at it.
Yeah, so some of our listeners have been giving their suggestions on Facebook. Donna Davis Fisher writes, be as professional as possible and flood the airways with facts using short answers. Dems tend to over-explain, and then they lose half their audience. Plus, Americans aren't as intelligent as we once thought. Renee Shapiro says, plenty of us care a great deal. We want accountability and protection of our democracy. Betsy, do we have any idea what the GOP counter narrative might look like? As we talked about, the presentation is going to be largely in unison from members of the committee. How will the GOP respond?
One key piece of the Republican response to the Select Committee's project is going to be emphasizing the security failures that happened in the lead up to the attack on the Capitol building. And there's no question that the planning, intelligence, and security postures the day of the attack were woefully inadequate, and that there's lots of blame to be distributed both among the FBI, Capitol Police, even the U.S. intelligence community for failing to see warning signs that were all over the place and that were, in some cases, very, very public. We expect Republicans to focus on those failures and to essentially look to highlight the extent to which the people responsible for the physical security of the Capitol building failed to do their jobs. A challenge that's going to exist, though, for Republicans in making that narrative is that we know the January 6th Select Committee is also looking at this subject matter, and the Select Committee is just way, way bigger and way better resourced than the sort of ad hoc Republican project that's been going on in tandem with and sort of parallel to the January 6th Select Committee's probe. So it's possible that there will just be some redundancy there, which, you know, if that's the case, isn't necessarily the most powerful messaging tool. And of course, at the same time, you're going to have Trump himself pushing back much more aggressively and directly against the January 6th Select Committee's communications and arguments regarding his direct culpability and ultimate responsibility for the attack on the Capitol building.
Jack, what do you think the Republicans' plan will be here? Will it be focused more on discrediting the evidence put forward by the committee, or will it simply be a matter of trying to run out the clock until after the November election? Of course, the idea is if the Republicans take back control of Congress, this whole committee goes away.
Right, right. Well, I think that they will follow the lead of Fox News, which will do its worst. There's no question about it. Tucker Carlson, you know, his testicles will be tanned and ready to, you know, night after night, tear into the committee, the people on it, using the nicknames that Trump has put out there to for the various people. And so we're going to have a lot of that, a lot of just, you know, counter-propaganda. And I think that that will essentially cue the Republican politicians. It seems to now, and I expect it will then. They'll sing from the same hymnal. They'll be on Tucker and the rest of them. And they'll just have their, you know, alternate view of reality.
Right. To the extent that the committee is seeking to change minds among members of the public, how will these hearings do that? I mean, you pointed out that one major difference in this investigation is that it's an investigation of something that played out live, that we all saw happening in real time. If you contrast, say, Watergate, where Americans largely didn't really pay any attention to it for a really long time, until those public hearings kind of solidified the attention of the American people. Here, it's been in the news. We saw it happen. Is it going to be a harder job to try to change minds to the extent that that's what the committee is trying to do?
I think it is harder. The Watergate public hearings really solidified in the public's mind what was going on after a long period where it was just drip, a daily news, Bob Woodward and others revealing things piecemeal. But the hearings, you could see these guys squirming in their chairs, and you could see that they were lying under examination. And that went a long way. The public made their own mind up when they saw that. What we don't have in this case is we know what happened on that day. That was all in public. We don't know what was happening behind the scenes in the White House yet. And we don't know the conspiracy and how long that was planned. It was obviously planned months in advance. And we don't know that part of it at all, except in the broadest strokes yet.
Betsy, what happens procedurally after these hearings are concluded? Where does the investigation go from there? Will the House vote? Does the Senate play a role here?
After the hearings are finished, we would expect the Select Committee to ultimately release some final printed product that captures the totality of the work that they did. You know, probably not everything, but that can serve sort of almost as a reference book for people looking back and putting together historical records of what happened on January 6th. I don't know that there would need to be action by the Senate unless or until the Select Committee releases legislative recommendations. In terms of changing things and preventing a similar attack like this from happening, the most consequential thing that Congress can do is change the law, particularly the Electoral Count Act, which without question has a lot of vulnerabilities that didn't really matter until all of a sudden they did. If Congress wants to push for legislative change as well as just for taking the sunlight as a disinfectant approach, then I would expect that type of action would be a natural follow-up to these hearings. That said, of course, midterm politics make things complicated. Limited floor time makes things complicated. So it's a lot for the panel to manage in the coming months.
Another listener, Ray Russell, writes on Facebook, people are tired of all the hearings that result in nothing or little found, but it does give face time to the politicians. The public wants inflation tamed, the border crisis quelled, and for the administration to do something that gives them hope. Jack, we're coming out of a pandemic. There is a war that is raging, that is keeping, that is staying in the headlines. Is there going to be, aside from those who are already dug in on their sides on what to believe, is the committee going to face a problem of apathy or the public's attention being turned elsewhere?
The polls suggest it will. The appetite for the revelation seems to be dim on the part of the public, and what our listener wrote in seems to be paramount: inflation and, for the Republicans, the border. And we're going to see more about that. But if the committee can follow, can bring home to the public what Jamie Raskin, one of its key members, says, if it can do this, it will have made a significant contribution. He says this was a coup organized by the president against the vice president and Congress to overturn the election. If that can be brought home, they will have discharged their obligation before history that Ray says is unprecedented. And everybody who can pay attention, who has the mental independence to pay attention, will see something very, very grave. And I think that will my hope is that it'll so damage Trump that he won't be able either to win the nomination or even run for the Republican nomination, because that's the great test coming up: Trump losing the next election and pulling the temple down around him.
And Ray, I want to bring this back to what you said at the start about the importance of this investigation, because it's not just uncovering wrongdoing and potential lawlessness, but it was an attack on democracy itself. Now we've talked about all the ways that the committee will have to fight confirmation bias, other things that are distracting them, and apathy. How do you get across that very fundamental message about protecting democracy in this environment? Did we lose Ray? I will throw that, as we seem to have lost Ray, but I will throw that question to Jack then. How do you make that message, given all of these other ways that the American public may be focused elsewhere?
I think it's very difficult. And this is partly for the historical record and partly, I think, to bloody up Trump. And if it can do those two things, then it will, it seems to me, to have succeeded. Whether that will work or not, the key thing would be, are there enough even diehard Republicans who think, my God, we can't nominate this guy for president, not with this now huge baggage and potentially Justice Department prosecution, we can't do it. If the committee can do that, that's a service to the American future.
And Betsy, of course, it's an election year that's going to be hovering over all of this. How do you think that will impact what happens with this committee from here on out?
It's a good question. We know that Democrats are feeling deeply pessimistic going into the midterms. Midterm elections are almost always really rough for the incumbent president 2 years into the first presidential term. There's no question Democrats are not looking forward to November with any particular level of hope or glee, although maybe some of them are. The January 6th committee's work gives them, politically, one topic that they can talk about where the Republican rejoinders are just not particularly compelling. There's a host of issues, as we've mentioned, that have generated real frustration among voters and that are very difficult for Democrats to talk about. The Afghanistan drawdown, without question, is something that still leaves a lot of voters feeling deeply frustrated and in some senses grieved as well. inflation is affecting families across the board in this country. Those are topics that Republicans would love to be talking about. January 6th is pretty much at this point. One of the things that Republicans just don't want to get into and that Democrats are leaning into.
We have to leave it there. Thank you, Betsy Woodruff Swan. Thank you to Ray Smock. And also thank you to our analyst, Jack Beattie. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.